Good morning. This is JB West on the D-Day beaches of Normandy, otherwise known as Jeff J. Brown. And halfway across the planet, I am joined by my comrade in arms, JB East in New Zealand, James Bradley. How are you doing?
Hey, Jeff, I'm doing great.
Hey, listen, for the fans out there, James is a great writer. He is going to base his discussion today on his two China books that he wrote, The China Mirage and The Imperial Cruise. They are both outstanding books. I interviewed James about those two books, and I highly recommend that everybody go to the library and check them out. And especially The China Mirage, covers a lot of what he wants to talk about today because it seeps into what happened after World War II. So James, take it away. You are a font of knowledge and experience about this. So tell us what you'd like for us to know.
Well, I don't know if I'm all that, Jeff, but you know, everyone knows about the military-industrial complex, and those words were coined by President Dwight Eisenhower, former five-star general, in 1961 in his farewell speech before John F. Kennedy took over. So everyone, you know, if you say military-industrial complex, they say, oh yeah, you know, Eisenhower, 1961. But what is the origin of the military-industrial complex? He was complaining about it in 1961. And what people don't realize is that the Eisenhower presidency was bookended by speeches with a general begging the United States not to be taken away by a military-industrial complex. In 1953, the first big speech that Eisenhower gave to a national audience was from the Statler Hotel, April 16th, 1953. He was a new president, and this was hooked up, you know, when they went nationwide, they would do television hookups, which meant, you know, they went from New York to Chicago and hooked up and then on to Los Angeles. So this was a big deal, and it was broadcast nationwide. And what Eisenhower said in this speech, which is now called the Chance for Peace speech, he said, and I quote, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron." So this cross of iron evokes William Jennings Bryan's famous cross of gold speech, which was very well known then. So now you have a new president who's a former general saying, hey, armaments, jets, bombers, they cost too much. And he broke it down for the citizenry. He really worked on this speech to bring it home. Let's not spend money, so much money, on the military. And, you know, this is a general saying this. So then in his farewell speech in 1961, again, I want to make it clear that he bookends his presidency with calls to the United States not to get caught up in this military-industrial complex. So in 1961, he's on national TV, and he says, "Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. Now, Eisenhower worked on this speech for 2 years. He went through 51 drafts. There's a book on this. I can't remember its name. But this was not something he thought up in the last month. He gave his heart and soul to identifying the military-industrial complex. And in some of the drafts, you see that he called it the military-industrial congressional complex. But Congressman asked him to take out that word, congressional complex. So listen to what he's saying. He says, until recently, we had no armaments industry. He said, just recently, we created a permanent armaments industry. And he said, this is new in the American experience. So what was he talking about? Why was he saying this was new? I mean, you know, think about it. President Theodore Roosevelt, President Taft, President Woodrow Wilson, Harding, those presidents never complained about the influence of the military-industrial complex. FDR didn't, Truman didn't. Why is Eisenhower all of a sudden saying this is new to the American experience and we have to watch out? Well, to find the answer to the origins of this military-industrial complex that Eisenhower was calling out, we have to go back to the presidency of Harry Truman. And in my book, The China Mirage, I detail how Truman had a council of what were called the wise men to guide him in international affairs. And the number one wise man was Dean Acheson, his Secretary of State. And Dean Acheson was you got to read the book. I mean, a big ego and very domineering and very intelligent. And you know, it was his way or the highway. And he had great influence over Truman. And the origin of the military-industrial complex comes from NSC 68. You can look it up. This is a secret document, National Security Council Document Number 68, referred to as NSC 68. And this document was completely secret. Eisenhower was referring to this when he said, we recently created an armaments industry, but this was top secret and not declassified until the 1970s, so he couldn't finger it. And this was a plan to militarize the economy. I couldn't tell you the truth, but now I'm going to tell you the truth, the background to the origins of the military-industrial complex. So let's go back to the 1940s. 1945, World War II ends. President Roosevelt is dead. Harry S. Truman is the president, and he has this council of wise men. Now, the reason I named my book The China Mirage is because for a generation, Americans had been told that China wanted to be just like America, and that if we supported Chiang Kai-shek, the dictator at the time, China was going to become Christianized. You know, there'd be little white churches on every hill, and there'd be potluck suppers with Chinese eating with knives and forks. And this sounds almost cute the way I put it, but it's true. FDR called Chiang Kai-shek's China the greatest democracy in the world after America. This was Chiang Kai-shek who had political prisoners in dungeons underneath his bedroom. Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine, was a missionary son born in China, and he propagandized for Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek was on more Time covers than General MacArthur, FDR, or Winston Churchill. So the Americans were just bamboozled, just propagandized about China wanting to go the American way. Pearl Buck is the only author who had a number one New York Times bestseller for 2 years in a row. It was called The Good Earth. And in The Good Earth, those Chinese peasants, well, they wanted to be just like America. So Americans were going along for a generation believing that China was going to be just like America. Just the Chinese were striving to be like America. And then all of a sudden in 1949, this pagan named Mao Zedong comes out of a cave. He's dressed in pajamas and he takes over China. America was shocked. And this was a shockwave that went through all across America. And it was a time called Who Lost China? Senators and congressmen and newspaper editors built careers on who lost China. Now, when the Russian Revolution happened in 1917, nobody said who lost Russia. We never said who lost Brazil when they would change their governments. But who lost China was because America had been so propagandized that China was in our back pocket, that China was destined to follow the American way. So there was this idea of who lost China. The Republicans taunted the Truman administration. You lost China. Stupidity at the top, treason just below. So on January 30th, 1949, there was a 31-year-old congressional representative by the name of Jack Kennedy. This is the guy who goes on to become President Kennedy, but now he's a skinny little congressman in 1949. And he gives a speech in Salem, Massachusetts, and he says, "We entered into combat in World War II with Japan to preserve the independence of China." Hey, folks, did you know that? Read the book. You know, history shows that we went into war against Japan because they bombed Pearl Harbor. But what history has not told is that for a decade, Americans were being propagandized about how China wanted to be just like America, and China had invaded Japan had invaded China. And so the Japanese were horrible. They were screwing up with this China mirage. So we cut off Japan's oil to discipline them. And then Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. That was not an invasion of the United States. They bombed Pearl Harbor so they could just continue to take over the rest of Asia. They didn't think that America would get involved. But Kennedy is saying, we entered into combat with Japan to preserve the independence of China. If you said that right now, people wouldn't know what you're talking about. But back in 1949, it was China, China, China. And that was the reason we went to war. And Kennedy goes on to say, we went to war, we gave our lives out there in the Pacific, and there must be some nefarious actors in the State Department that caused us to lose China. So 1 year later, on February 9th, 1950, Senator Joe McCarthy gave a speech. And he said, "Today we are engaged in a final all-out battle between communism, atheism, and Christianity. As one of our outstanding historical figures once said, when a great democracy is destroyed, it will not be because of enemies from without, but rather because of enemies from within." And this was McCarthyism. McCarthy held up a sheaf of papers and said, "I have in my hand 51 members of the Communist Party who are working in the State Department." And then McCarthyism blew up for about 3 years. McCarthyism was rooted in the "Who Lost China?" hysteria. He ended his speech by saying, "In my opinion, the State Department, which is one of the most important government departments, is thoroughly infested with communists." So again, this was McCarthyism. And he was asked a week later about the State Department. He said, McCarthy said, communists and queers have sold 400 million Chinese people into atheistic slavery, and they now have the American people in a hypnotic trance, headed blindly toward the same precipice. So the evil communists were going to do to America what they had just done to China. So now let's go to Truman. Truman was president at this point. And as I said, he relied upon a circle of wise men for foreign policy advice. And these wise men became the architects of the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and the Cold War containment policy. And the number one wise man was Dean Acheson, Secretary of State. At the time, newspapers wrote about the age of Acheson, that he was so dominant that they called the Truman administration the age of Acheson, because Dean Acheson generally got what he wanted with Truman agreeing with him. Now, so we're in the Truman administration. The Who Lost China hysteria is out there. And then Korea comes upon the scene. Now, Korea, because of its location, was the crucial keystone in North Asia. Japan got into China through Korea, which I detail in my book. What's that book's name? I'm talking about the China Mirage and the Imperial Cruise. I detail about how Theodore Roosevelt greenlighted Japan's invasion of Korea and then into China. Now, on August 10th, 1945, the day after the second atomic bomb exploded over Nagasaki, wise man John McCloy divided Korea into two. And, you know, this was a guy in Washington with a map, and he just drew a line on the 38th parallel, and all of a sudden we invented two countries, North Korea and South Korea. We didn't ask the Koreans what they thought about this division of their ancient land. And Koreans were even more outraged to learn that U.S. officials thought that they could govern South Korea with the help of the Koreans' former Japanese colonial masters. We beat Japan, we moved into Tokyo, and the military got used to working with the Japanese to govern Japan. And the Japanese knew Korea better than the Americans did. So we said, we'll work through the Japanese to govern Korea. Can you imagine being Koreans? They had just suffered a Nazi-like occupation of the Japanese since 1905, 40 years of occupation. And then all of a sudden, the Americans are telling the Koreans, hey, we're going to govern you with these Japanese helping us. So North Korean leader Kim Il-sung, he had begun his military career fighting the Japanese in the spring of 1932. He was a famous fighter against the Japanese. He was a hero in Korea for fighting the Japanese. And his government of North Korea was first of all and above all anti-Japanese. Now let me bring up the economic scene that's happening at this time. World War II ended, America was untouched, had a booming industry, but we needed the rest of the world to get up to scale to have a decent world economy. We weren't doing this to be nice to other people. We needed Europe and Japan to get going for those wheels to move so that we could make things and export them. So one of Dean Acheson's major concern was reinvigorating the world economy. And in Europe, the U.S. adopted a program of economic aid called the Marshall Plan. And then the Marshall Plan for Asia was called the Policy for Asia. This is National Security Council Document 48-2. So according to NSC 48-2, Japan would become Asia's industrial economy. Now, folks, this is a bunch of guys in Washington who knew very little about Asia. And we had conquered Japan. We said, boy, those Japanese are pretty efficient. We'll just make them the center, the number one industrial economy of Asia. And then we're going to connect up the other Asian economies to Japan. We'll keep these other countries subservient to the Japanese. And then we'll have this big Japanese industrial machine, and these other countries will call these other countries, Korea, Vietnam, and whatever. They're going to be supply consumption machines within the U.S.-Japanese orbit. And then to keep this all in order, the American military would provide an umbrella of security for Japan to make sure that the other countries stayed in line and consumed Japanese products. Now, the wise men in Washington didn't understand that their policy for Asia looked to many Asians exactly like Imperial Japan's recent attempt at empire. To other Asians, it was as if the U.S. was greenlighting another era of Japanese dominance with American backing. When the North Korean leaders, realized that Washington wanted Japan to once again dominate Korea, they perceived a mortal threat. Can you imagine this, folks? The Japanese are coming back into Korea. We've got to get armed. So this, the wise men's policy for Asia was a blueprint for American disaster in post-World War II Asia, because the U.S. military was called upon to enforce a Japan-centric model, a for-us-or-against-us policy, designed to contain the evil Mao Zedong and the communists. Bruce Cummings is the leading historian on Korea. Folks, if you want to know about Korea, line up Bruce Cummings' books. His last name is spelled C-U-M-I-N-G-S, Bruce Cummings, a great guy. And this is a quote from him about the policy for Asia. Quote, "The United States would now do something utterly unimagined at the end of World War II. It would prepare to intervene militarily against anti-colonial movements in East Asia, first in Korea, then in Vietnam, with the Chinese Revolution as the towering backdrop." So, I mean, do you get it? We, you know, secretly, Truman is approving a plan that would later get us into the Korean War, fighting in Vietnam, and, you know, where we still have troops trying to discipline the Asians. Now, the problem that Truman and his wise men had was that the Marshall Plan and the policy for Asia, they were attempts at stimulating the global economy, but Germany and Japan were still not performing very well. And this threatened slow growth for the United States economy. So Dean Acheson sat down and analyzed the history of the U.S. economy. And he noticed that during World War II, there were massive production of armaments for use around the world. Our factories were making tanks and jeeps and, you know, beans and bullets, and they were being exported around the world. And this was absolutely great for the United States economy. And Acheson thought, maybe we need a military stimulus for the economy. Maybe that's the way to get it going. So now we come to NSC 68, National Security Council Document 68. This is the birth of the military-industrial complex. Acheson's top secret policy was laid out in this document, and it called for something completely new in American history: an enormous U.S. military encircling the globe to protect the war-making capabilities of its allies. This was a euphemism that was in that document. What war-making capabilities meant was Indonesia has certain, let's say, minerals that our war machine needs. So the the military has to protect that. And then we'll sell arms to the Indonesian military and we'll train them. And then we'll be able to export high-tech military things to them. And again, this was to contain communism worldwide. Now, folks, the American Constitution was written by patriots who feared the corrosive effects of a large standing army under a powerful executive. But NSC 68, with no information to the public, turned this on its head. So it's here and in the Truman administration that Acheson tilted government funds away from domestic programs and towards military stimulus. You know, people are scratching their heads, you know, why does America have this big military industrial complex? And why don't we spend more money on education or on our schools? Well, you have to go back to NSC 68 and see that this was government policy to get the economy going. So President Truman signed the document NSC 68. But at that point, it was only a wish list and it had no congressional funding. So it was, I can't remember, like 60 pages of you know, how America should reorientate itself. But it wasn't briefed to Congress. It was just a piece of paper, just a wish list. And following U.S. tradition, after World War II, Truman had drastically reduced the military size. In 1945, the U.S. military had more than 11 million members and a $60 billion budget. But by 1948, Truman had trimmed this to fewer than a million military members, and the budget was only $13 billion. Now, North Korea crossed the 38th parallel into South Korea in force on January 25th, 1950. Bruce Cummings writes, "The North Koreans attacked the South because of fears that Japan's industrial economy and its former position in Korea were being revived by recent changes in American policy." Can I repeat that? Because people, you know, wonder, how did Korean War start? Bruce Cummings says, "The North Koreans attacked the South because they feared that Japan's industrial economy and its former position in Korea were being revived by American policy." So for many North Korean soldiers, this fighting was a continuation of their recent war against the Japanese. So now you have a small incident out in Asia. The Asians didn't look at that line between North and South Korea. This was an ancient kingdom. This was no long-term border like the border between Canada and the United States or the border between China and Russia. This was an imaginary line that the North Koreans crossed. But for the wise men and their containment policy, they concluded that Moscow must be behind this. And it was just a North Korean action. So you have to remember that, you know, at this time, Truman was under fantastic pressure for who lost China. And this was a huge political problem for him. So he's already accused of losing China. And then now with this North Korea crossing the line, the wise men, you know, blew up the importance of this North Korean situation. Now, Dean Acheson, it's documented, knew nothing about Asia. He studied, you know, the Western classics. He really knew nothing about Asia. Secretary of State, he had made 11 trips to Europe, but he couldn't be bothered to make one trip to Asia. But when things flared up in Korea, Acheson took over, knew nothing about Asia, but all of a sudden he was the expert. And he sat alone in a room, scratching on his yellow legal pad, a little notes. What were the Soviets up to? Where else would Moscow probe? Into Berlin? Greece? Turkey? Iran? So he was, the wise man Acheson was telling Truman that he had a worldwide conflict on his hand and that Truman had to move quickly and commit troops to Korea without consulting Congress. And Truman, who was being beat up by Who Lost China, thought this was a good idea. And so he green-lighted American troops into Korea without declaring war. Folks, Joe Biden just, you know, we're at war with Russia, really, through Ukraine, through that proxy war, and we don't even consult the American public. We don't declare war anymore in Vietnam or Iraq or Libya or on and on and on. And it started with Harry Truman and Dean Acheson. So they commit troops, and so here, let's go back. So we have NSC 68, which is just a document about how we have to militarize the world to get the economy going. And then as soon as that's signed, there's this surprise movement in North Korea that Dean Acheson thinks is a worldwide threat. So Acheson later observed, quote, June 25th, June 25th means the crossing of the line from North to South Korea. So quote, June 25th removed many things from the realm of theory. Korea seemed to and did confirm NSC 68, end quote. Martin Walker is the author of The Cold War, and he says, quote, without the Korean War, the costly plans of NSC 68 would have faced a number of critical problems for the Truman administration, and the invasion did wonders in building the American Cold War position on a world scale. Dean Acheson later admitted in a speech to Princeton University that Korea came along and saved us. So do you get it? We've got NSC 68, a inert document, and then Korea comes along and saved us and proves to Congress and the American people that we have to have an alert military and we have to have a large armaments industry. And this is what Eisenhower was referring to, something new in American history. So this irrational fear of worldwide communism as a result of the wise man's misunderstanding of a small Asian Civil War persuaded Congress to dramatically increase funding for the military. The author Martin Walker wrote, and I quote, the first defense budget presented by President Truman after the war began was for $50 billion, the precise figure Acheson had hoped for in NSC 68. The U.S. Army doubled to over 3 million men. The number of air groups doubled to 95 and were deployed to new bases in Britain, Libya, Morocco, and Saudi Arabia. Everything changed with Korea. American diplomacy, defense budgets, and military reach exploded across the globe, end quote. So Bruce Cummings, the author, concludes, the Korean War was the crisis that finally got the Japanese and West German economies growing strongly. And the Korean War vastly stimulated the U.S. economy. American defense industries hardly knew that Kim Il-sung would come along and save them, but he inadvertently rescued a bunch of big-ticket projects. The Korean conflict would transform the United States into a very different country than it had been before. Now it was a country with hundreds of permanent military bases abroad, a large standing army, and a permanent national security state at home. So folks, that's the origin of the military-industrial complex in the Truman administration. NSC 68 was the kindling, and the Korean War was the gasoline on the kindling that lit the fire. And all of a sudden, we had an excuse for military bases around the world, because Koreas might happen anywhere. we got to look for it. So when you see the 1,000 bases around the world, when you see an almost $1 trillion a year budget, when you see us revamping our nukes, and gee, how come we just finished with Afghanistan and then a few months go by and then, oh my God, here is a new receptacle, Ukraine, for the military industrial complex. Folks, it's not an accident. It was designed that way. It was written into the American government. It changed the American government forever. And it was called NSC 68, top secret, until the 1970s. So there you go, Jeff. That's how it started, and we're reaping the whirlwind ever since.
Yeah, James, this brings up a lot of memories I have reading both the Imperial Cruise and the China Mirage. And also in your book, you mentioned, you know, people love Truman, you know, because he was probably the last president that we had that was not a millionaire. And so he was a simple guy, a nice guy, but obviously the Council of Wise Men, he was pretty much putty in their hands, and they were neoliberal neocons, and they wanted to, you know, take over the world. And under Truman, not only did this happen, the NSC 68, but the Joint Chiefs of Staff was created. I'm pretty sure you mentioned this in your book. The CIA was created.
The whole national security state, the Pentagon, the CIA, all that's under Truman.
The CIA was created, Frank Wisner and nine other Wall Street lawyers, you know, created the CIA. The Department of War, the name was changed to the Department of Defense. The National Security Administration was created. The National Security Council was created. I mean, that this was, as you said, and it sounds like it was all, you know, involved around these wise men who could easily dominate and manipulate Truman. So it's and then just the way, you know, like the way that, you know, they cynically, you know, drew a line across the 38th parallel and in the Korean Peninsula, and they cynically drew a line across, and that was to stop. There was supposed to be in both Korea and Vietnam, there were supposed to be national elections, and when they realized that Kim Il Sung was going to win, they created two countries, and when they realized that Ho Chi Minh was going to win in Vietnam, they drew a line across the 17th parallel to create two countries. I mean, it's just, it's so cynical. It's just like the Sykes-Dicko, you know, lines, you know, drawn in the Middle East, where they just cynically cut up, you know, Jordan and Lebanon and Palestine and Syria. And taking land from this country and this culture and this civilization and cutting here and cutting there, you know, the Brits and the French, just empire, it has so much blowback and has so much, leaves such a trail of devastation that it's just hard to imagine.
You know, David Halberstam wrote the best book on the Vietnam War called The Best and the Brightest. So that was his version of the wise men, the best and the brightest who ran the war, McNamara and all those brainiacs. And in the 20th anniversary edition, he wrote an introduction and he said, if I could rewrite the book, I would emphasize more the effect of who lost China on the 1960s. So I brought up the who lost China thing, that Truman was under that cloud. Well, guess what? When Joe McCarthy was beating up Truman about who lost China, who was watching this politically? Senators Kennedy, Senators Nixon, Humphrey, Johnson, everyone who ran for president in the 1960s had seen the knife fights over who lost China. And you can see that later, Kennedy and Johnson are making policy decisions on Vietnam with this "who lost China" cloud over them. They didn't want to be politically destroyed by "who lost Vietnam." So this "who lost China" thing was a cloud that lasted for 20 years and screwed us up in Asia, because we didn't understand why Mao came to power. And we thought Asians were just these little ants that, you know, we could build a little thing over here and push the ants to left or right, that we could control Asia, you know?
Yeah, it's really, for you who spent years in Asia and traveled all over the place and lived and worked there, and me living and working in China for 16 years, I mean, you just... When you see what, you know, what the cultures and the civilizations and the people and the governments are like, it's just it's amazing that the rest of the world can be so bamboozled, and you and I have talked about the big lie propaganda machine. Well, as you said with Luce and his publishing empire. That big lie propaganda machine was in high gear, you know, decades and decades and decades ago. It didn't just start, you know, recently. So they just keep grinding out, you know, China, 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 and communism, 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 you know, and then, you know, COVID, 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 Russia, Russia, Russia. They just beat us to death, you know, with just relentless propaganda, and it's overwhelming, and unfortunately for 99% of the population, it works.
Yeah, and to me the big thing is that, you know, we should just come home and worry about our cities, our homeless, and stop thinking about the rest of the world so much. I mean, I'm from Wisconsin, and if people from Louisiana came up to Wisconsin and took over the Wisconsin government and started to run it, you know, Wisconsinites wouldn't appreciate it. You have to know Wisconsin. You have to really know the place to run it. You know, if the people of San Francisco were all of a sudden governed by troops and leaders from South Carolina, you know, they would bridle at that. You know what I mean? But yeah. We assume that we know something about Vietnam or Laos or Thailand or China or Korea or Japan or Taiwan or whatever. And it's ridiculous. You know, we just can't know that much about these ancient societies. So, you know, with the Taiwan issue, I've got a great way to ease tensions. Just America come home. Taiwan's part of China. We don't have to go to war, and let's fix Chicago. Mm. You know, let's fix Washington,
absolutely,
D.C. I mean, as the president gets in his helicopter to go to Camp David, I wonder how many homeless he helicopters over. You know, let's fix those problems. Cut the military down by 90%. We don't need all this fighting. And nobody wants to invade the United States. We don't need it.
I think another factoid that you brought up in the China Mirage is that this military industrial, and it is congressional, because they have, you know, they have the Raytheons and the Boeings and the McDonnell Douglases have made sure that there is at least one military production facility or storage facility or reconnaissance facility in every one of the 535 congressional districts in the United States, you know, from Maine to Florida to Texas to California to Alaska. Every county in the United States has at least one military has one military facility of some kind, so that way they've bought off they have been able to buy off Congress, so they can go to the congressman and say, you know, your, you know, depot and, you know, Lawton, Oklahoma or whatever, you know, we need you, did these bring jobs, you know, and blah, 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 blah. They it's really, it has really overtaken our culture and our society. I interviewed a lady, Dr. Joan Roloffs, and she writes about this a lot, how the entire economy in the United States now is totally dependent on the U.S. military industrial complex. And they're in TVs, they're in the movies, they're in sports. You know, you go watch the Yankees in New York, and there's flags flying, you know, and they pay millions of dollars to sports venues, you know, to, you know, bring out soldiers and veterans, you know, to appeal to the people, you know, to their patriotism and support of the military. They've really got, you know, the military industrial complex that Eisenhower so presciently, of course, he lived it. He was a 5-star general and a very successful one. You know, he was warning us about this. And unfortunately now, you know, his nightmare has come true. And this octopus, you know, this military octopus is just strangling the United States. And I would like to point out that that's why they had to get rid of Trump, because Trump was the first president in decades who tried to bring home troops. He brought troops home from Afghanistan. He brought troops home from Germany. He tried to negotiate with Kim in Korea. He was trying to reduce the military, and I think that's one of the big reasons that they threw the election to Biden, because he was a huge impediment to their ambitions.
I agree. And you know, you've got to follow along, and it stimulates the economy. So I think we better wrap it up. But I'd say to the listeners, just Google NSC 68. The document is online. It's absolutely fascinating, and you can read, you know, the birth of the military-industrial complex, mm-hmm. and why, as Jeff says, we have military factories or you know, the military economy has seeped into all of our congressional districts. The birth is NSC 68. So yeah, I hope folks enjoyed that.
Thank you so much, James, JB East, and I will post our interview that we had about your two China books on the webpage. I will also post the your author page on Amazon. So that people can, and I always tell people, hey, you don't have the money to buy it or buy it used, go ask your library or your school or your university or your place of worship to buy these books. They love to have their membership, you know, public libraries, they love to have people recommend, members of the community recommend books. So ask the library to buy it so that other people can read James' fine work. Anyway, this will be JB East. JB West and JB East, see you in The Hague, number 24. And I will also put a little link so that you can find all the other 23 on the website. Thank you so much, James, for a wonderful enlightening presentation, and enjoy the conversation.
This is JB East in New Zealand saying goodbye to JB West in Normandy. See you, Jeff.